Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Grant Padalko, an editor at our English language website, rferl.org, and I'll be your host this week. On this week's program, we meet Farshid Manofi, the Association of International Broadcasting's Radio Personality of the Year. We're quite proud here at RFERL because Farshid is the host of a popular satire program right here on our Persian service, known as Radio Farda.
This show tells everything about the government, about the news, about the people inside Iran, but in a funny way and just truth. That's it.
And post-punk, lo-fi, experimental rock. We meet Russian musician Dan Telegin, a veritable one-man band.
This release is totally mine. I made everything myself. Recording, mixing, instruments, vocal, lyrics, and this presentation. Everything is mine.
But first, my interview with Dr. Tomika Tilleman, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's senior advisor for civil society and emerging democracies. Tilleman's job is to figure out how the U.S. can best support civil society activists around the world at a time of great upheaval in the Middle East and North Africa, and as activists press hard to effect good governance and improve human rights in countries such as Iran, Afghanistan, Belarus, Uzbekistan, and Russia. Tilleman recently visited RFERL's Prague headquarters, where I sat down with him to talk about Secretary Clinton's more aggressive efforts to incorporate civil society activists into Washington's policymaking process. Thank you very much, Dr. Tilleman, for joining us here on The Blender.
My great pleasure.
Can you explain, in a nutshell, the U.S. State Department's initiative regarding foreign civil societies?
The United States and Secretary Clinton and President Obama have recognized that we are in the midst of an extraordinary change in the world. And as a result of both the availability of new technologies and also shifts in culture, we're seeing voices and citizens outside of government play an increasingly important role in how societies are managed. And we've recognized that we need to adjust our policymaking accordingly. And so we have taken a number of steps at the State Department, beginning with a huge top-to-bottom review of every single program and every single bureau at the department that was conducted last year, called the QDDR, Quadrennial Diplomacy and Development Review, which is a real mouthful if you say it five times fast, to reach out to partners beyond the state. We've taken steps including the creation of a very important new civil society dialogue that Secretary Clinton launched in February, which uses architecture that we previously reserved for our engagement with our most important governmental partners, countries like India or Pakistan or China. And we have retooled that and repurposed that to provide sustained high-level engagement with civil society actors around the world on a number of issues where we see the potential to forge a common agenda. And these include topics like governance and accountability, democracy and human rights, empowering women, labor, religion and foreign policy. So topics that go to the core of what civil society is and the important independent role that it plays in our nation and many nations around the world, but also areas where we see the potential to work together. Ultimately, we feel that our societies are supported by three different sectors that function like three legs of a stool. You have governments where political activity takes place. You have the private sector where economic activity takes place. And then you have civil society, which helps to keep the other two in balance. And we are trying hard to do what we can to defend civil society organizations when they come under pressure, and then to amplify their voices around the world in all cases.
Why hasn't this sort of outreach been done before by previous administrations?
What we've seen over the course of many years is an evolution in the United States engagement with civil society. And there has been civil society engagement in the past. But I think it's important to put this work in context. If you look at the grand history of diplomacy, countries have been developing the tools and the architecture for engaging with one another over the course of thousands and thousands of years, and have, as a result of that, become relatively adept at cooperating with each other. the field of government engagement with civil society, and particularly international engagement with civil society, comparatively is in its infancy. And so this is an evolving field. It's a very exciting field. And we feel it's critically important. If you look at the United States or many other countries around the world, you see that virtually every major social advance in our history has come through the work of civil society, whether that's the abolition of slavery, women's rights, civil rights, environmental protection. And that story is repeated over and over again in countries around the world, and it's why we feel a need to focus on this issue.
Can you just provide a brief description, a brief definition of civil society?
Sure. It's a term that we throw around a lot, and it's important that I think we have a common understanding of what we're talking about. You can define it in two ways. The first would be those outside of government and the private sector who come together and work through peaceful means for positive change. You can also say that it's organizations, civil society organizations, religious organizations. Journalists are a critical part of civil society, writers, intellectuals, academics, who, again, aren't engaged in the work of government or the work of for-profit enterprise, but still play a critical role in ensuring the health and progress of their societies.
Can you speak about any of the initiatives that you've taken regarding RFERLs, some of our more challenging broadcast countries, for example, Iran, Belarus, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan? It seems to me that those type of countries, for one thing, there's not a civil society that's very well developed in those countries. And two, I don't imagine that the governments are very pleased to have the U.S. State Department sort of nosing around and encouraging this sort of activity. How does that work in those countries? And can you provide some examples of what you're doing in those areas?
I can provide a number of examples. I think it's also important to step back and look at our activities there in a broader context. The United States welcomes civil society groups from other countries to operate in the United States because we recognize that they enrich our culture. They build the relationships that support our bilateral cooperation. And we find them to be very productive actors in our society. By the same token, we think it's important for other governments to acknowledge that international actors should be able to work with civil society organizations around the world, and that those organizations and those relationships are not something to fear. They're something to embrace. And we feel strongly that when the relationship between government and civil society is functioning properly, both sides stand to benefit. I'll give one quick analogy and then speak a little bit more directly to your question. When I was growing up, I was not a very good soccer player, but I had a good coach. And I wasn't always delighted when my coach would encourage me to run another lap or do another drill. But slowly, as a result of that practice, I became a better soccer player. And when the relationship between government and civil society is functioning properly, civil society can play a similar role. They can encourage government to take steps that they may not want to take on their own, but it ultimately makes them more effective and helps them to serve their people better. In tough countries, of course, there are varying degrees of receptivity to that. We see serious pushback in a number of the countries that you mentioned. Some nations like Iran have a rich tradition of civil society, and we think it's tragic that the government there has turned its back on that tradition and is no longer willing to embrace the historic role that actors outside of government have played in the evolution of that great civilization. But we continue to do what we can to support engagement with civil society leaders from those countries. And many of those countries, or rather civil society leaders from many of those countries, have and continue to participate in the civil society dialogues that Secretary Clinton and other senior department officials are holding around the world.
But in many of our countries, RFERL's broadcast countries, as I said, the civil society is not very well developed and is actually frowned upon by many of the governments there. It just seems like a very, very difficult thing to nurture these organizations when there's so much working against that.
This is a generational challenge. And the upside is that every so often you find a case like we saw in Tunisia earlier this year. where individuals came together and took common action for the common good. And there were a number of extraordinarily courageous civil society organizations in Tunisia that had been there performing the tough work of trying to speak out on behalf of fundamental human rights and human liberties for a long time in the midst of tremendous pressure. In fact, the longest existing human rights organization in the Arab world was headquartered in Tunis. And yet, in the space of a couple of months, we saw an earthquake that completely transformed the geopolitical landscape of that region. And civil society going forward is going to play a very important role in the evolution of Tunisia's democracy.
How do social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, of course, how do those play into what you're trying to achieve?
On two different fronts. The first is those tools are making it easier and cheaper than it has ever been in human history to pull people together and to organize individuals as part of civil society. And this is really a tectonic shift. It's something that the world has not seen before. And in North Africa and elsewhere, I think we're already seeing some of the results of that shift. The other side of that story, though, is that those same tools in many instances make it easier and cheaper for governments to be responsive to the requests of civil society and the demands of civil society. They make it easier for governments to be transparent, to make information available to their citizens, and to provide the services that people need. And so we see this as part of a larger opportunity to hopefully ensure higher degrees of accountability, higher degrees of transparency, and hopefully higher degrees of cooperation between actors inside government and outside government.
I'd like to ask you about the benefits and the drawbacks of overt State Department involvement in foreign civil societies. I'm aware that at a recent tech camp in Lithuania, which is another State Department program aimed at foreign activists, there were concerns about the security and safety of participants who were coming from particularly oppressive governments, countries. Shortly after the event, Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko issued a statement condemning the United States for attempting to create unrest in Belarus by training activists across the Belarusian border. How are you balancing your efforts with the unique security needs of some of the civil society groups you want to support?
I'll speak to that on two fronts. The first is that we, I think, would reject the notion that any of these efforts are designed to sow unrest. They're designed, in fact, to strengthen the social fabric of countries around the world. They're designed to ensure that individuals are able to resolve their grievances peacefully, that they're able to work with governments in a constructive fashion and not in an adversarial fashion. At the same time, we recognize that some governments see the situation differently. And that's why, for example, the civil society activists who participated in our tech camp in Vilnius did receive training on how to use some of these new media tools safely. And we think it's important for activists around the world when they take advantage of these new tools and new opportunities that are available, to do so in a way that does not endanger their safety.
Does an association with the U.S. State Department ever taint these organizations or make them more vulnerable to harassment?
Ultimately, the practical answer is there are some governments that don't like the United States, and that is a serious concern that we deal with. The other side of this, though, is that we work with many governments who share these priorities, who share a commitment to these principles. And much of what we do in the world is not United States government programming. It's programming that is conducted in partnership with democracies that, again, have a common commitment to basic human rights. So we would reject the notion that at the end of the day we're advancing American values or an American agenda or even a Western agenda. These are issues, and this is an effort that speaks to what is most basic in our humanity, the desire to come together with one another and serve the common good.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Tillman, for joining us here on The Blender.
My pleasure.
З вами Радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда.
Айче Радіо Європа.
Азатить Радіо.
Азатить Радіо.
28 languages.
21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
Farshid Manofi has been working in radio since he was 18, with a passion that is palpable when you listen to his programs. Or so said the Association of International Broadcasting in awarding Farshid its International Radio Personality of the Year for 2011. Farshid is the host of Pas Farda, a popular satire show on RFERL's Persian service, Radio Farda, that has more than 500,000 weekly listeners.
همه ی رویاهامون تو همین روزا به حقیقت نزدیک میشه. نمیدونم امروز، فردا، شایدم پس فردا.
Farshid's one-hour show pokes fun at Iran's leaders, their policies, and life in general under the regime of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. His show airs 5 days a week, but like all of his Radio Farda colleagues, Farshid is officially banned from the airwaves in his home country. To celebrate his win, we invited Farshid into the Blender studios to talk about his show and why satire seems to really connect with the Iranian audience. Farshid spoke to correspondent Kristen Deasy.
So Farshid, welcome to the show. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do on this, I believe it's a daily show every night. Thousands of people are listening. Can you kind of walk us through what you do?
First of all, I want to say hi to all the listeners of this podcast all around the world. And thank you for having me here in this blender. My show, Radio Pas Farda, which means Radio the Day After Tomorrow, is a satirical show, and it is in Persian language, Farsi language. And Iranian people all around the world can listen to it. Radio Pas Farda launched about 1 year and a half ago in Radio Farda, the Persian service of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. And actually, next week, we will celebrate the 300th program. Pas Farda is an hour daily show which runs from Saturday to Wednesday with many listeners in Iran. And we have huge fans inside Iran, and we know that they appreciate what we do.
How do you know that?
From Facebook, from SMS, emails. Actually, we have, right now, we have almost 55,000 fans in our fan page on Facebook.
Wow.
Yeah, and also we got approximately 200 emails and SMS every day, and about 70-80 telephones.
So people really love your show. Why is that? I know you're quite a funny guy, but they tune in for the jokes, for the characters. What is it about your show that makes it so successful?
Because in Iran, we don't have something like satire. And everything in each program, in every media, is under control by the government. Because we only have state-run radio and TV. In a satirical show, you can make jokes about anything and anyone in all level of governments and organizations, and you should have criticized everything that is not satisfactory for the citizens, but in a funny way. I think that is why this kind of program is more popular in Iran. And, I had some popular show in the state-run radio before and TV. Also, and many people knew me from those shows, and I think somehow I'm their voice right now. Those people who are not allowed to even breathe freely in their country without any freedom. Not only they have not the freedom of speech, but also they cannot even choose their own clothes. And I can feel each second of each part of the Iranian life. And I know what they want. I know their interests, their needs. And the most important things is that I think like an Iranian. And I think this is why.
This is why it works.
Yeah.
So you think like an Iranian. But you said there's no satire in Iran. Do you mean there's no open way to make fun of popular leaders? You have to do it in this indirect way, in between the lines and somehow in a hidden manner?
Actually, we don't have it at all.
Really?
Really.
Even in like the political cartoons or some of the authors?
Nothing.
Wow.
No, nothing.
So your show is truly innovative.
Yeah.
It's truly unusual. No wonder you have 50,000 fans on Facebook. You mentioned that you had a show in Iran with the state-run media.
Yeah.
Can you tell us why that ended? What happened?
Maybe because my show was the first show in state-run radio was somehow like satire. And we made the jokes about everyone, about government, about Congress. And after a while, they censored us and censored me and told the producers that shut down the program and it's enough.
And you lost your job over that.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't have a program till about 2 years, 3 years, yeah. And after that, I came here.
And do you come from a radio family?
Actually, yes. My father was working in the radio. That's how I became very interested to work in radio. And I started working there when I was 18. First, I used to act in radio plays, and after a year, I became host. And for several years, I hosted a wide range of radio shows, from sports shows to literary shows, you name it. But then I found my voice in social satire.
How do you think a show like Pas Farda makes a difference?
Because I told you, I think I'm the only voice of Iranian right now, maybe. And because young people inside Iran don't have any freedom, freedom of speech and everything. And this show tell everything about the government, about the news, about the people inside Iran, but in a funny way and just truth. That's it. Because I think the people of Iran want to listen the truth these days.
Great to talk to you, Farshid. Thanks so much for sharing your story.
Thank you very much.
That was Kristen Deasy speaking to Radio Farda's Farshid Manafi. In addition to Farshid, the Association of International Broadcasting also commended RFERL's Kyrgyz service for The Invisible Women of Osh, its story on the victims of gang rape during the ethnic violence in the south of the country in June 2010.
Just a reminder that The Blender is the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. RFE brings radio, internet, and television news programming to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and the Balkans.
And if you'd like to get in touch with us, it's very easy. Drop us a line at podcast@rferl.org or by leaving a comment on the Blender section of our website, rferl.org. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday. On this month's Ear to the Ground segment, Romanian music journalist Lucian Stefanescu introduces us to Dan Telegin, a Russian rock musician whose latest album, Mua, was influenced by Glamorama, the 1998 novel by American writer Bret Easton Ellis. Here's Luchin.
Today we are listening to music made in the Russian town of Samara, a music described as post-punk, lo-fi, experimental rock. The musician is Dan Telegin, who earlier this year released an EP named Mua at a net label based in Moscow called Clinical Archives. In the short presentation of Mua, Dan Telegin writes that if a personality was a house, these songs would be found in its dark corners. All houses are alike, he says. Necessary things carry out their usual functions, but the interior is never good enough. So the hidden things, perhaps even from the eyes of the owner, are much more interesting. Though there is little fun in concealed and intentionally forgotten stuff. Dan Telegin also mentions in the presentation a novel by the American writer Bret Easton Ellis, Glamorama, a book some claim is a satire of modern celebrity culture and consumerism. Bret Easton Ellis is best known for his work American Psycho, adapted for the screen in 2000. I spoke to Dan Telegin about his EP, and this is a fragment of our discussion.
This release is totally mine. I made everything myself. Recording, mixing, instruments, vocal, lyrics, and this presentation. Everything is mine.
You were influenced by this Ellis's novel, Glamorama, and I quote, a thick dust layer of loneliness, things that made you feel like a hero of Ellis's Glamorama, asking, who the hell is Mua? And you get no clear answer. So who is Mua?
Actually, there is a hero that travels all over the world, and he doesn't understand who he is. So when he asks his friends who made some mistake, he asks, who did it? And they answer to him, who? Mua. And he asks them back, who the hell is Mua? It's all over the book. And actually, main hero doesn't know who he is.
You can say that your music is something about this travel to find your own identity.
Yes, like in Steppenwolf, you have a lot of personalities inside, and you can be any of them, and you are free to choose to be anyone you like. And I'm trying to find what personalities inside me are more interesting.
Dan Telegin from Samara, Russian Federation. I should also mention he is a journalist writing mostly about opera and rock music.
Я человек, похожий на редкую птицу, человек, похожий. птицу человек, похожий на редкую птицу человек, похожий на птицу. Я человек, похожий на редкую птицу человек, похожий на редкую птицу человек.
The Man Resembling a Bird by Dante Leggin from his solo project called Mua. And one more thing, he is currently playing bass and guitar in a band from Samara, a band called Kont Ora Kuka. My name is Lucian Ștefănescu. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned to The Blender.
And that's it. That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks so much for turning on the blender. We'll be back again next week with another show. Until then, this is Grant Padalko. Take care, everybody.
I said the time.